Dear listeners, welcome to Faces of Digital Health, a podcast about digital health and how healthcare systems around the world adopt technology, with me, Tiasza Zeitz. Patient-reported outcomes have become increasingly integral in healthcare for assessing the effectiveness of treatments from the patient's perspective. It sounds as a logical next step in improving clinical research and care provision. However, gathering data can be more difficult than you may think. It's difficult to get to marginalized communities, there's language barriers in collecting data, and there are cultural aspects that impact patient responses. So how can you design useful electronic solutions for patient-reported outcomes and make sure that the interpretation of the results is correct? I discussed this with Mustafa Ali Syed, researcher at the Manchester Academic Health Science Center at the University of Manchester, and Ben James, co-founder and chief design officer at UMotiv, an electronic patient-reported outcomes and engagement platform designed to help with clinical and real-world research. Both speakers are co-authors of a recently published paper titled Exploring the Cross-Cultural Acceptability of Digital Tools for Pain Self-Reporting. Enjoy the show that might give you food for thought about how to approach patient populations and what to consider when trying to get their feedback about new therapies or digital solutions. And if you haven't yet, make sure to check out our newsletter. You can find it at fodh.substack.com. That's fodh.substack.com. Now let's dive in today's discussion. Ben and Mustafa, thank you so much for joining me on Faces of Digital Health to discuss patient-reported outcomes. How can we actually measure them? How is the whole perception changing around why patient-reported outcomes matter? What can companies even do with them? What's the impact? And also some of the challenges when it comes to gathering patient feedback when we're talking about different patient groups, patients with different ethnicity, different age groups. So when we start digging into this discussion, we can see that it's actually very complex. So maybe we can start with a very general discussion. Why do patient-reported outcomes matter?
I can take that. Yeah, thanks so much. The patient voice is hugely important in all phases of research. So when you're collecting data, it's massive. That voice is there and that data is collected. At this point, it's being mandated by the FDA. It's part of the sort of the 21st Century Cures Act, and regulators want electronic data capture from patients to ensure that submissions are really high quality. And most new drug filings include PROs or real-world data to ensure that sort of voice is there. It's a fundamental when you're talking about humans that you have that patient input and that data.
You've been in this space for over 12 years. What do you see has been changing in this time? So what's measured in patient-reported outcomes? Is the idea from the research perspective changing in terms of what should be measured?
Yeah, I think it's been around for a long while. I think what has changed is the ability to capture that data. I think the importance is increasing in terms of the need for the data, but also the way of collecting it has become much easier and much more effective. And things that are usually measured are things like symptoms, quality of life, treatment satisfaction, things like that, that are critical to the sort of research and having that patient voice and making sure that it's captured in the data. I think the importance of it has increased over the last few years just because it's being mandated by the FDA and things like that. But also, I think it's been recognized as is the right thing to do as well. There's a huge importance in that voice and ensuring that people are represented in the trials. The ability to capture it as well has increased. So obviously, the last 10 years, the technology shift has been absolutely massive, and people having their own personal devices that are capable of capturing this data not only become more important from a regulatory point of view, but also just it's been much more feasible and much easier.
Yeah, one of the speakers in the previous episodes that is an advisor to MedTech and pharma said that if in the past the FDA didn't took you seriously if you were using wearables for your clinical trial, today it's expected that you have them because of the measurements that you might want to take. But from the patient perspective, I always wonder what actually happens when you measure that data. To which extent is that insights that you get just something that companies do because regulators demand that? You know, you have to have a contact with the patient, you have to have the contact with the customer to get a specific certification. But do they actually change anything based on that feedback?
I think it depends on which phase of clinical trials you're talking about. In the real world, there's often a lot of patient data captured that is used from a in a kind of more general way, and all the way through to marketing phases to understand how products are being used. In the earlier phases of clinical trials, that sort of primary endpoints are collected from patients, and you can become critical to how stuff is being used. So I think it can be used from a sort of an understanding the kind of the additional information around drugs and the effectiveness, but also it can be the absolute kind of primary endpoint spec as well. So it's hugely important.
One of the big challenges in clinical trials that has been highlighted a lot in the last few years is the diversity of the sample. In the past, women in their reproductive time were traditionally excluded from clinical trials. What's been shown during the COVID pandemic because of the oxygen monitors was that basically a different skin tone can impact the measurements. So we opened up this whole field of the impact of diversity and ethnicity on the way we measure outcomes and also create solutions. And you actually did a study where you tried to highlight how pain perception differs among ethnic groups and what does that actually mean also on patient-reported outcomes. Can you talk a little bit more about that? So what did the study look at? What did you try to find out and what were the findings that you came to?
Yeah, thanks. Very pleased to be here. So I think so the important thing to recognize here is that there's a dual burden. So not only prevalence among some groups is higher than other groups, but also the impact of pain is also higher. And it is very important to understand that why is that. And for that, we started to work on just developing that distinction between ethnicity and culture, because ethnicity is that variable which we normally see in research. But actually, and to present that problem, we use ethnicity as a variable. But when we will try to find a solution for that, we need to look at the culture, because culture is encompasses all those factors which are related to lifestyles, people, perceptions, beliefs, religions, so all those factors which would really impact how people would perceive about their pain and how they would report it and who they would report it. And second reason was actually my own ethnicity, so my own cultural background. So that also kind of, telling me that what I'm reading in the literature, it may not be exactly the same for people who are from different ethnic backgrounds. People would assign different meaning to different things just because of their cultural background and belief. And this really motivated us to start exploring that how pain is perceived in different ethnic groups. We know that different ethnic groups are affected with chronic pain differently, but how they perceive about it and how they deal with it, because their management practices would be different, how they deal with it. And this is the kind of information perhaps which clinicians would want to know, that what people are doing to manage their pain and how they can account in that factor when they are having pain consultation with those patients, so that they will have a holistic view and they could have better treatment options for patients. In our work, we engage with three different ethnic groups: white British, black Africans, and South Asians. And definitely particular focus was on culture, so how they perceive pain. So we found differences in their perception and how they talk about pain, whom they talk about pain. So and it really refers to people's pain reporting behavior. If I'm having pain, then whom I will go to speak? Maybe a doctor. if not doctor, then maybe few people will prefer to talk about their pain with their loved ones, with the family members or friends before even going to a doctor. So their behaviors are different, which are linked with their cultural background. This is what we need to understand, and this is what we try to explore in this work.
And to which extent have you further discussed the findings of the study? So we know that differences exist. There's been a lot of kind of harm and misconception in the past about how, for example, black people experience pain. And what I have more questions here than anything. So is it just that the perception is different? Are the pain levels actually different? And how do you even start addressing that? I think that also in digital health, there's this question if we could find some sort of a more objective measurement of pain, because at the moment it's just on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your pain? What kind of innovation do you see in this field? How can we improve the measurement of pain to make it more objective?
We need to understand that how the pain perceptions are developed. It's not a static thing. It develops over the period of time. And it is developed based on people's experience and how they interact with the health system. And then they develop that perception. So, for example, if I go to a doctor and speak about my pain, and I'm telling them, for example, my pain is 5, and they don't take any action, then what will they do next time? They will say, okay, my pain is 8. So now they have exaggerated. This is what provider has maybe considered an exaggeration. And now there is a provider bias which is at play. And now they are not given the right treatment, or they're not given the treatment which they are expecting. So I think so there is a huge opportunity in technologies like these, like this, when you start collecting this information and you are collecting that information over the period of time, then instead of having a snapshot, which a clinician used to have, just a snapshot of a 1 day of pain situation, instead of having that and relying on in making decision, now they will have a better picture of pain, how it is changing over the period of time. And then you can start, and not even clinician would start thinking more objectively, but patients also who are reporting their pain, they would also see, okay, I was maybe reporting too much pain, but actually that was, and then they will start correcting their pain reporting also. So I think so in the context of technologies, and especially making the design easy enough so that people can use it regularly, it can create massive difference in how health system would respond on these outcome measures.
Ben, how do these findings translate into the design of the solutions? In one of the blog posts on your website, you mention, among other things, that it's really important, for example, if there's a human body that's used in an app where patients would mark their pain, that's not just a body of a white male or female. So there's a lot, to unpack there. So how does, for on the one hand, research impact that, and also how do the existing models impact the reporting that patients do? Patients, did you, for example, detect that patients didn't want to report on their outcomes because they didn't feel that the design of the app is representing who they are?
Yeah, I think it's a complex issue, and I think the findings are really interesting. We, you know, the context of this study was done in a, we've been working on an application for capturing pain on a body map. So very much when you go to a clinician and you'd be asked to draw on a piece of paper and you'd sketch where your pain was. Now they're really crude, and if you've seen one, the drawing is not very realistic of a person. It's very male, and this has been used for years. So we were exploring with Manchester as a wider piece of research and collaboration around how we would improve that data capture and make it a little bit more objective. Because obviously you have a pencil on a piece of paper is interpreted. We can obviously capture a very similar thing, but we've also looked at ways of dividing the body into grids and looking at and how we would have different levels of pain. And it's a very complex area. One of the focuses of the workshops was looking at what the user interface would look like and what the body map looks like. We found that people expressed a real desire to have the body to look more like them. So it's to do with gender, body size. But actually, when we tested it, it was really mixed feedback based on that. So I think it just shows you really need to test these ideas. And one of the other challenges you have around capturing data is that you need a sort of consistency in the way the data is captured. If you're talking about body area and talking about percentage of pain or intensity of pain, if you need to do that over 4,000 people, you need some consistent way of measuring between those people. And I think there's a real difference between capturing data for self-management, understanding your own pain, versus essentially where a clinical trial, where you've got to have consistency between the data and you need to have objectivity and ensure that there's a consistent way of recording data.
You mentioned that you got mixed feedback or results when you tried to adapt the outlook of a human body. Can you talk a bit more about that? So what was the challenge?
I can talk about it from a design point of view. I think people have a different way of perceiving the body that they're communicating pain onto. So very often it's very two-dimensional. We looked at 3D versions, which gets quite complicated. But I think people immediately have a different way of thinking about what they're actually drawing onto. Does the corner of the arm go around the side or is it the front? And so there was that. But also just down to the actual details, is it a more generic non-gendered or non-sex body or versus something that's more realistic? And then obviously they looked at the ability to customize that based on you, which people didn't seem to respond to. I think you really only get that information once you present people with a prototype or something to look at and see visually, because it's a very visual thing as well.
So there's another interpretation of that, and that's also given through when you see it in cultural context. So people would like to report their pain on a gender-specific mannequin, but when they want to transfer that information to clinicians, say they want gender-neutral mannequin, so that their identity is not obvious from the pain mannequin report. That's what I think. So one of the participants was concerned about having a mannequin and reporting it as such if it is gender-specific.
You did a lot of research around this topic even before you actually did your own study. So Mustafa, can you maybe talk a bit more about what you generally see in the field of gender and ethnicity and the impact on medical care and how we need to take this into account in future research? Are there any research projects or efforts that you see that seem very promising? What's your general perception of this whole complexity that we are now starting to address?
Yeah, so I think so. Recently we start working on a research program that focuses around understanding digital health inequities. So what I mean from this, so when we are introducing digital technologies and care pathways, so they are benefiting all rather than creating inequities for some groups. And as part of that work, we started working with South Asians, because when you look at the literature, you will see women are affected more. And to understand that, we need to look at the culture. So they normally don't work. And when you look at the socioeconomic status, that's also poor. Their education level is poor. Because when we try to say South Asians are affected more, actually, we are not saying every South Asian living in the UK is affected more. So we need to start thinking about, and that's only possible if we start bringing an intersectionality lens into understanding these inequities. So who are those subgroups within South Asians who are affected more? And we need to engage with them more. These are very basic steps. We haven't done anything massive, but even those small steps will really help us to reach those who actually need help, who are impacted by these digital technologies, who are not achieving better health outcomes like others are achieving. So we are just in that program, we are working on identifying those subgroups within the subpopulation. And normally these are seldom heard, very hard to reach. And we need to figure out the ways through which we can connect with them. Because trust is a big issue, not only for health research, but also for digital technologies. And trust issue will not be addressed by researchers like us. We need to collaborate with these communities so that we have models in place through which we can introduce these technologies. That means we are not directly going into community, but there are gatekeepers who are helping us to reach these communities, and then we can start understanding these issues and then start developing these technologies. Because even so far in our research, we have engaged with South Asians, and I don't think so we have so far been successful in engaging with those South Asians who are suffering from chronic pain more than others. So I think so this is what we are learning at this stage. And the only way we can create impact, engaging with the right groups, engaging with the right people, and developing technologies who are addressing their needs rather than my need, because I'm also South Asian. So my needs are different from their needs. So we need to understand their needs, basically.
What you mentioned is that, as always, the problem isn't the technology, but the biggest challenge is how do you actually get to those targeted populations. Are you seeing any specific trends there, or like how did you, for example, try to get a representative sample for the study that you did?
Not only us, many researchers, and I have seen many people who are making right efforts in the right direction and trying to engage with those communities. I think so. The first impact would be improve participation in research. So that's the first impact we need to achieve first. Improving health outcome will come later on, because first we need to understand why, for example, these people are suffering more than others. Once we understood that, we started developing these technologies, then you will start seeing the impact they had in health outcomes. So I think so. Expecting impact on health outcome now is maybe not the right thing to expect. Maybe we need to have these communities in our research more frequently, and particularly those, because language is a big barrier. And we start just thinking about how only language barrier can translate into multiple disadvantages. So you would not have better economic opportunities, you would not have better health literacy, you would not have better digital literacy. So all these disadvantages will, combine together, and then they will have poorer health outcomes. So we need to engage with those people. And at the moment, we focus more on bilingual rather than unilingual, who can only speak non-English language, because at the moment there are not infrastructure available within research institute where they could run these activities in their local languages. So this is, I think so, the biggest challenge, which many researchers are recognizing. Focus on linguistic and cultural adaptation of these digital tools is huge at this moment, which is very great opportunity. And if we keep capitalizing it, then I'm sure we will get there we will want to go.
Yeah, I was just thinking the other day how, for example, now that we are increasingly communicating with clinicians or family doctors through online means, for example, here on the patient portal, you have a limited number of characters that you can write in one message to the doctor, which obviously makes sense because the GP won't have time to read novels. But at the same time, this means that patients have to be very articulate in clarifying what their challenge is. Even if you're a native speaker, you already have that problem. And now add to that the complexity of a different language and communication. Ben, how does all this translate into designing the solutions? There seems to be that so many things that you need to think of that it's almost impossible to imagine a solution that would work for everyone.
No, I think that's a really good point, actually. Obviously, there is a huge advantage in having translated digital technology can be translated and it can be adapted to communicate in different languages and capture the same data, but you've got the questions are written in different languages, so you can get that quality across. And that happens in clinical studies now. You'd have instruments that have been translated into different language, and they obviously ensure that the data is then consistent, and that's part of the process. But yeah, I think the thing that we found over working with patients a long time and building interfaces and technology, I think the one thing that we always find is having the ability to configure your technology to the context. I think there's a lot of health, and certainly when you get into the clinical trial space, there's a lot of technology that is very focused on the data, and it doesn't often work in the context and give people the prompts that are relating to them. So I think the thing that we found is that you can design an experience that perfectly fits one situation, but then you then apply it to something else and you've got the wrong language, you've got the wrong prompts, you've got... So what we found is configurability is key. So you need a system underneath that's highly robust and collects data in a very sort of organized way. But actually on top of that, you need to put a layer of communication that gives people much more of a contextual experience that speaks to them. If you're a patient on a real world evidence trial where you're not speaking to a site, or you're someone that's in a very short focused window where you're collecting diaries, you need to use a different language and a different experience. And I think so much of the technology that's been put into, certainly into clinical trials and research, has been coming from the point of data systems for clinicians that are adapted for patients. And that's a completely wrong way of doing it. Where we've come from is we've worked with patients to start with and then brought that experience into this space, and it gives you a totally different experience and a different set of rules to work with. So I think, but the thing is, there's no one right answer. What you need to do is make sure that the language you're using is contextually right, it's right for that patient group, it's right for the cadence of the study or the research. Is it a study that's over 5 years? You're going to talk to people in a different way than if it's over 30 days. There's a different intensity to that. So I think the one word I always come back to is the design principle is configurability. You need a robust platform that does the things that you know are best practice, but then you have to build this layer on top that gives it that that user experience that they're expecting and is customized to that environment and context.
So what's your experience in terms of what kind of standards, so data standards, should be used in research? What kind of data standards do you use in research? And also, what's the impact that, for example, generative AI now has on the interpretation of the results? Because I'm assuming that there's still a lot of free text that's used in some cases for patient-reported outcomes. It's not all just 1 to 5 or yes or no questions.
Yeah. I think it depends on, again, it depends on the type of research you're doing. When you go towards the real world and the kind of more marketing end of it, you end up with more free text and it's much more open. When you're in a clinical trial setting, you wouldn't often collect free text. You would try and things would be a validated instrument, so the questions are consistent. The way you collect the data and you present the data is regulated, so you have to have data standards there. Well, there's just been a paper that I've been part of as part of the eCOLA consortium, which is about best practices for migrating or patient recording outcomes to an electronic format, because there's a whole way of migrating these measures that has to be consistent with the way that you present it on the screen. So there's always a tension, I think, between ensuring that your data capture is valid and it is validated and is meeting the requirements of the data, but also then you want to wrap that in a human experience that people can. I think that's a difficult balance, and I think you just have to, that's why you need the configurability to ensure that you, sometimes you're going to be capturing free text in a completely different type of study, but other times you'll be very locked down, but you also want to wrap that in as much human-centered behavior as possible to give the best chance of engagement. Because that is a huge issue in trials and research, is the engagement you get from participants.
You basically mentioned the differences between real-world evidence and basically clinical trials that have very specific endpoints and data that they want to capture. So can you dive into that a little bit deeper? So how does data gathering differ in clinical, real-world, and post-marketing research? To which extent do also the data sets in terms of the data standards differ? I think this is probably the question for both of you.
Yeah, the sort of is obviously generalizations. The clinical phase, you're driven often by a site, a research site, and you generally will get quite high compliance kind of later because you've got the site monitoring the data collection and there's much more engagement. It's still cited, ease of use software is recently cited as the sort of one of the biggest concerns for sponsors who are sponsoring these studies, and this is a kind of recent report. So there's a lot of work still to be done there, and you need to remove those barriers to compliance and engagement with the study. In real world evidence, you tend to have a much larger study where there may not be a site or an intermediary, and there's a much more direct to the patient. So you generally get a lower engagement rate. But again, using the technology in the right way can really increase that engagement. But the data sets are the clinical, much more written from a protocol. Things are much more locked down and is more less exploratory. Whereas something like RWE would be much more open, and you'd be collecting lots of different data, and it's more open, and you do get lower engagement in that environment though, so it's important to use those techniques. Mustafa, I don't know if you've got any on that one.
Yes, I may not have a better answer than Ben, but from my experience, I can tell you how not really setting certain standards, because Ben was saying that it's very hard to compare things across population if you have customizable variables within your digital tool. But I think the one thing is very important, because we are talking about here long-term conditions where symptoms of these conditions vary across time, and they are quite long-term span, over the period of a couple of decades, you can imagine. So in order to provide better cure to these, important thing is that the symptom variations are captured through these tools. And so like I was saying before, so for example, pain intensity, if that's a variable that we want to capture, my 5 would differ from other person's 5 because our perception is different. But one thing important we are capturing here is that I can compare my own results rather than looking at somebody else's results and then see whether pain treatment given to me is having an impact on my pain intensity or not. But when you put that in the larger context, I think so we might need advanced analytical techniques to see and tell how we can compare all these variables across population where there are differences because of people's different perception about pain. But this is what we need to achieve yet. But I think so one opportunity is right there, which like Ben was also saying initially, that these digital data collection tools, so this is the recent change within this space. But I think so one biggest strength of these tools is the computational power, the analytical power. So instead, because before you use what used to happen, you will have all these paper-based questionnaire, you will combine the results, you will analyze it, and that information will be used quite later in the time. But through these digital tools, if you're using right analytical techniques, you will get the information there and then so that you can decide what next steps you should take. So I think so this is the biggest strength of these tools. Standardization, I don't know when we will be able to get there, but I think so this is already promising.
Given that, Ben, you're in this space for 12 years, what's the advice that you would give to other software providers that are also in the patient-reported outcome space? What are some of the key learnings that you got to in the course of all the work that you did so far?
We started working with Parkinson's patients. So we built some technology around capturing symptoms, and we ended up working with patients very closely from the start. If your system is designed from a data point of view and then migrated to a sort of patient or human experience, I think that's where it's quite difficult. I think you have to start with a patient and or a user. We always try and start from a human-centered point of view, and I think that's a really good approach because you start your technology from the actual user, and it's much more user-driven, sort of human-centered design experience. Then you're going to get a much better result, I think. So my advice would be to start with the users that you're trying to work with.
If you can get to them, I think that's also something that can be very challenging, especially, I guess, for pharma industry, for example. They have a lot of limitations in terms of how much they can reach out to patients, which makes it very challenging to actually get useful information that they might want to need. So, Mustafa, what would you add to this question? I think we know what the problems are. The challenge is there's just no easy solutions in how to get all the feedback that you get and how to address everyone equally. So, where do you hope that the field is going to go? Or what are potentially some of the improvements that we are already aware of? We just need to figure out how to enact them.
Yeah, like you said, these issues are not new. For example, we have been seeing these health disparity for centuries, but I think so COVID has brought this very nice opportunity that we have now started thinking about. Okay, there are certain groups who might be affected more, and we need to know about those. And so I think so removing all these biases. So even researchers like us, we need to also remove biases and think that, okay, there are these groups who are disadvantaged. Remove this bias, I would say, just keep your eye out with an open approach and see where are these disadvantages, because there are certain disadvantages groups, but there might be others who are disadvantaged, but we are still not able to categorize them. So I would say if you're not closed in identifying these groups and we keep our approach open and engage with those communities and develop these tools, not keeping in mind what works for us or how we can help them, ask them how they want us to help them. I think so this will create a difference when we will start listening rather than telling them, okay, this is what I know from my experience and you need to try this. This is a kind of approach we need to take going forward so that, because one thing is very commonly heard when I speak to these people, that we are not heard. So not being heard is a very common phrase, which I guess you will all agree. So we need to start ensuring that they are being heard, and then we are developing those technologies which are there for helping them rather than developing the technologies to gain our whatever that is. But it is for their benefit, not for us.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Also, from the in the era of the importance of data, I think product managers or developers too often think about what would be useful for us, what kind of data would be useful for us to have about this patient, about this customer, not taking into the account that just because something is good for the product, that the user is going to be willing to take the time or share that specific data, because there has to be something in it for the patient as well. Are there any things that you would add here, Ben? Any mistakes that you commonly see in the field that innovators are making?
I think what you said then is really key. We always try to look at, we have a diagram, which is a Venn diagram, where you have the me and the we in the middle, where it's what's the common thing that you can introduce into these digital experiences that serves both the data collection purposes and the user's purposes. And again, I think it depends on what sort of phase of research or, you know, what if you're in digital health. But generally, we found the best results when there's something in it for the person, but there's also that sort of overlaps really nicely with the objectives of the research. And I think that's why you've got to have these experiences customized or allow people to make them relevant to the individual, because that's the key to real engagement. People are really aware of digital technology now and how it works for them. So I think if you introduce experience that is not two-way, then you're going to really struggle. So I think you just, it's going back to that point of looking at what's in it for both parties of the transaction to ensure that there's a really good fit. And I think that's a key to being successful for sure.
You've been listening to Faces of Digital Health, a proud member of the Health Podcast Network. If you enjoyed the show, do leave a rating or a review wherever you get your podcast, subscribe to the show, or follow us on LinkedIn. Additionally, check out our newsletter. You can find it at fodh.substack.com. That's fodh.substack.com. Stay tuned.